Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us here. And I'm delighted to moderate, I think, a conversation between Nadia and Timo. And maybe we could start by trying to explain why you're here together. I mean, I was initially invited to talk to Nadia, but I'm actually really happy to open up the conversation and have also Timo into the equation. And I'm personally very interested in the way you work together and how you collaborate and how this collaboration started. Without getting too personal, because you're also a couple. I mean, we don't need to hear that side of the story. Or maybe we do.
It's a great question to start with. It's a love story.
It's a love story, exactly. Let's do the love story right now.
A love story in all senses for the work, and first of all for us, but it became all quite organically. I'm basically an artist, and when I met Timo, who was doing his scientific research in Kommunikationswissenschaft, you say that in German means science of communication.
Yeah, basically sociology.
Sociology. Yeah. And I was doing at that time also my PhD in France. And we spoke very much of theory at that time. And once I finished my PhD, I concentrated on my artistic practice, and I really went into it. And Timo was doing in parallel his theory. And somehow, because we discussed everything, we slowly started to dig into things together also. And as the project grew, and I started to travel more, and I was not able to do certain everything alone, so Timo came into it and started to do concrete things, like, for example, organize things for projects, the technical parts, or take care of the web page. And while this was happening, I used to discuss with him the concepts and the ideas, and his input was very important for me to take distance about my... sometimes, you know, that when I have an idea, I'm very thrilled about it and think it's great, and it's good to discuss to see where are the weak points. Mm-hmm. So this dynamic was important to develop and to produce strong words, I think.
Yes, I hope so.
What I would call strong in the sense of the distance.
Yeah,
because he's very critical, and we sometimes fight about things. And this fight produces these frictions, I think, and produce
many frictions and resistance
on both sides. And particularly for this talk, as you asked why Timo is here, this show particularly was really produced from A to Z, hand in hand, and he actually officially curates the show with Rachel. And so Rachel's input is also very important. She's in the public, but she did all the the archival and the historical research, because we are in Berlin, and the show is basically based on the historical research of the building, and Rachel did all the archival. So it was actually hand in hand, the three of us. Mm-hmm.
So maybe to interrupt you and to let Timo speak.
Good point.
maybe we can start actually the conversation by tackling the exhibition here in London, the one which is about to open, and because you were somehow co-responsible of the research work. Can you just give us a little bit of an overview of the site, of a location, and how that has been informing and inspiring the work which is presented there?
So... Nadia always insists to have a kind of print relation to the places and to the situation where she's working and where she's installing her work. So we were in the situation that we had to adapt the works for the exhibition to the place where they are. It's a Tower House in London, which is today hosting mosaic rooms. So we wanted to do something which integrates with the mosaic room's history. And the first question was, what is the history of the Tower House? Because when you see this compound in Kensington, it seems that many houses were built at the same time. And there's just one house which has this name, like Tower House and the Tower. And it's on the corner of the Earlscott Road and the Cromwell Road. And together with Rachel Jarvis, we started historical research. We went to the archives, learned more about the history. And then we found that a former tenant or landlord of the house was Imre Kiralfi. who became the general director of many, many Universal exhibitions held at the old Earls Court Exhibition Center. Yes, the, this poster is a symmetry, it's a mirrored image of the guidebook cover of the Great Greater Britain exhibition that was organized, managed, and produced by Imre Kiralfi, the former owner of the Tower House. And Rachel found in the Museum of London an old illustration. Is an illustration? Is it
daguerreotypy
of the Grand Room, where is now the future rebound part of Natchez exhibition. And this was how the Grand Room looked like in maybe 1905. And yes, and this is where we Natchez started to work on site to learn more about the space.
I just want to make a small, very small anecdote and jump to what you're saying. I came to the mosaic rooms 2 years ago while I was having my residency at the Fina Foundation, visited it the first time, and when I came it felt very residential. It is a space for exhibition and like a gallery, typical gallery space, but it had really the feel of having like a salon, as if someone just left and was living there, moved. And that's why when I was approached by Rachel, we were seeing the talking about the space, and it was like, there is something about this house. And certainly, we are keen to know, first of all, who lived there and what happened there, and we could probably take that at the first point that we will build on. And then all of these amazing, actually, discoveries and surprises came from that first meeting with the Grand Room, which is still this. If you take off the furniture, the structures basically didn't change for 115 years. It's the same.
Yeah, and then you try to get through to the structure.
So what happened is that, again, Rachel, while doing the research and getting the images of how the space looked like at that time, we discovered that there were murals and frescoes in the ceilings. And so it was interesting for us to make something on the reverse. Instead of adding something to a space like an artist would do, invest the space by adding an object, we were interested to remove something and to reveal something, and creating an artwork by the negative. So that's why we were hoping to get the fresco, and we have invited a specialist working about color and layers and lasering to see what's behind. And after she investigated the space, we realized that the fresco was covered by plaster, so that was not able to get, but we found some gold. how do you call this?
Molding.
Seeding rose. And the gold has a particular context within the whole show itself, but I prefer to let you speak about this.
Yes, please, you do it yourself.
Just because of this historical digging, just the short story of the gold, about the Kiralfi and the gold, let's say.
Okay, so we got this, which was pretty cool. It came from this archival institute who did a UV scan about the different layers of paint on the Grand Room ceiling. And this was a confirmation of our hypothesis that there were different tenants and they modified the room. And this modification was at least a confirmation that once in a while it was totally different, and it was like Kiralfi wanted to have this room look like, and also that the later tenants of this place, they wanted to get rid of this history, the Victorian times and the Victorian interior. So what we can see here is a first two levels of emulsion paint, then it goes deeper to distemper, and we have a plaster. It's a dark thing in the bottom is plaster. So they removed the plaster and the mural, and they did a new plaster coating on the ceiling, which is bad because the mural is lost. And in the cross-section scan, you can see a surface of gold leaves, but not entirely covered, just a few pieces, elements are covered with gold. So, and when Natta did the scratchings, she exposed a few of these golden parts, and later we found that this gold is, it comes from the Victorian design of the room, so it's gold of the Victorian age. So, and what Kiralfi did in 1899 was the Greater Britain exhibition, which was a colonial exhibition about South Africa, and he wanted to get the empire into new territories in South Africa. To get the permission, he was the chairman of the chartered company, and he wanted to have the authorization to do mining in territories that did not yet belong to the British Empire. So he wanted the British Empire to expand, to get into these territories, that he and his company can do the mining. So, and this was the reason why he sponsored alone this part of the exhibition, Savage South Africa, where he hired Frank Phillis, an showman from South Africa, to gather nearly 200, also the number was 174 natives, and he brought them to London to show them as savages, because he wanted to create this idea that it's a dark country with underdeveloped, it's an underdeveloped culture, and it's good that the British Empire goes into these territories to
civilize them.
So, and this is as the spectacles they did. So it's already all about fighting and do primitive handcraft works and this kind of things.
Which is actually quite interesting, because we were having this conversation yesterday, where eventually it became understood that the majority of these people, they were actually acting or reenacting the image of themselves, that it was a spectres.
They approach. Were paid, so it's not at all salvaged that
exactly.
He caught them and broke them.
So it was really a show set up in order to reinforce or to substantiate a very specific agenda, which was a big colonialist imperialist agenda at the moment in time.
It's a kind of propaganda.
Yeah.
And it's even Frank Phillis, he said to journalists at this time that he had to hunt these people to come to London, but in effect they hired on, because the alternative was working in the gold mines and in the labor camps of Cecil Rhodes, the man behind the chartered company and who sponsored all this, and they were really good, they got a good they were well paid for this trip to London and to play the savage, to act as a savage for the London public. This is another image which is interesting, because in the center of this image is someone who was allegedly called Prince Lobengula, the son of the Matabele king Lobengula. It's the man with all the feathers and in the center. And this is how he was seen in London, how he walked around in London at the same time. So this is makes it pretty clear why there was a representation, and not why, but that there was a representation which was pretty fictional. And the question was why. It was just because Cecil Rhodes, who was the only private entrepreneur who sponsored the mining section of this exhibition, he just wanted to get the public support in London that the empire expand into territories to do more gold and diamond mining, more digging.
And this is where we go. I would like to go back to A Color of Time.
Yes.
And then we can go again to Faces, because these two works are linked, actually. Where I started, the digging of gold inside of the Grand Room. That's why I wanted to speak now about the these images. So the whole thing of the propaganda, it was about to push the British Empire to dig more gold in South Africa, and the whole Great Britain exhibition with the Salvage Africa was a propaganda effect. So it was interesting for me how I was like using a scalpel and cutting inside of the time, and also doing like a kind of digging for probably that same gold came from South Africa. So there is something like a circle circular. Going, yep. And it is also a circular form. So what I basically did when I took off all these layers, I broke them, chopped them, and produced smashed them and produced a pigment, with which I have done a canvas. And this piece is called A Color of Time. And I just took the measure of one of the doors so that everything is related to the space. Mm. So it's a little bit kind of yellowish.
Yep.
And the color is the result of these several layers, because after Kiralfi, the tower house became the headquarters of the army. And after that, it was a conservator for music. And later on, the Qattan Foundation was situated there. And so the color really, the scans also shows all of these layers. And faces?
Yeah, faces.
Is the other work also that is in the show now?
Yes. When we realized or found out that this totally made up, it was a fictional mise-en-scène, we decided to do something else and to use photographical portraiture representation in a way that is used to show this person, this character with individualism and alone. It's just a single person. And we did this, it's all kind of digging as well.
Yeah, it's kind of extracting.
We extracted each member of this casted Zulu and Swazi
groups
which were represented as white hordes. We extracted them out of the group images to show them in a typical traditional portraiture format. And I think that the oval form was especially used to get rid of the context at this time, because in these days, the plates, the photographical plates, were pretty expensive to develop. So what families did was they took one family picture where everybody was looking overexcited. And then later they extracted the little smaller.
That's how they had the amulets also. They carried the portraits of the
loved ones.
So we somehow got back to this old tradition of. Because what happens in a group, especially the way they were presented and they were dressed, somehow their personality, individuality, and I would go further and say humanity, was taken away.
For sure.
And presented in a more animal like form. And going there and really taking every portrait and concentrating on their look and their expression, and you would see that everyone looks very different and quiet in a kind of meditative and very proud position, even if they were sitting in this ridiculous, non-convincing context. And it was as if like a comatique, you know, something that you have to do and urge and repetitively go and try to extract everyone and give it back its personality. Even if these people are gone, it doesn't make any sense, actually. It's as if going back and rectifying something, in this sense, redoing something.
Yeah, well, at least to show them as the actors they were.
Yeah.
And not as...
Salvage.
Yeah, not as the acted result.
Yeah, there is a way to, as we said before, extract them and just give them back again a sort of a sense of individuality outside of the collective identity that it was constructed for them at that moment in time, which I have to perform for the benefit of the West, I guess.
Yes. And there's another interesting point that at the time of the Greater Britain exhibition, these South Africans, they were interviewed by not only the British press, but also by Dutch journalists, German journalists, and they could answer the questions in German and
language.
Dutch.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's kind of, yeah, that's going back to what we were saying at the beginning. It was meant to be like, you know, sort of a, or affirming a British superiority on other races or other nationalities or identities, whereas conversely there was much more.
And superiority over the colonies.
Of course.
To explain why they're colonies.
And I know you've been extracting with 32 of these
32,
portraits.
32, yeah.
And it's kind of presented as a sort of a portrait gallery.
Exactly, in the tradition of a portrait gallery.
What
we respected that visual language.
Oh, yes. And in the same room, we can also see another work, which is almost indexical as the other one, so in that sense. And it's also reflecting this kind of idea of a tension between collectiveness and the individuality and how you lose your individual identity when you're framed into a bigger picture, as in this case.
So these two works, they are opposite to each other, and they are corresponding, but they're also kind of oppositions. And probably it has to do also with the whole mythology or how different cultures work about the collective memory and how they stop it and store it. So, for example, for most of the Central and South African cultures and mythology, for them it is very important the relation to the earth and the relation to their ancestors, which is related to their ancestral place. And for the African, it's hard to imagine to go away from their land and to do war and to leave the people who died there. If this happens, they would directly try to
bring
it back, because all of this, their metaphysic is related to the present and to the past. The future is hardly existent.
Mm-hmm.
And the present and the past is completely in a direct relation to their ancestors who didn't die, who are living dead. So it's a completely different way of seeing compared to the Occident, to the West, where not only the colonialism, but it's going on. The wars are mostly done elsewhere, apart from the First and Second World War II, and I guess the West had learned that it's horrible to do it at home. So it's happening elsewhere, and we are just seeing all of these huge symmetries, not only American, I worked about American here, but German, French, I mean, just immense memorials. Are spread all over the world. And what I did in this case, it's in Tunisia. So we have the American cemetery for all the African, all the Americans that fell in Africa during the Second World War. Their memorial is in Carthage, in Tunis, next to my neighborhood. So basically what I did is to collect the earth from the cemetery and put it in these small bottles. And under each bottle, there is the number of security number of the fallen soldier.
This time, they did not have service numbers. It was the normal U.S. security number.
Yeah.
And
which is the only form of identification visible in. Well, you said that some of them also have names, right? In the actual graves.
They have their names, the ones that they recognize.
That they are recognized.
And the ones that they don't recognize, there is a saying that...
Known but forgot.
It's
a security, social security number was the only identification mark to find out the name of the fallen soldiers. So the fallen soldiers without social security number, they are known but forgot.
Yeah, indeed.
And
so the structure of the cemetery and the memorial.
Yeah, so this is a replica, actually, again, a cut and an imprint. The number and the position of the boxes corresponds exactly to the position in the cemetery. So it's as if you come and you cut. It's not the whole cemetery, it's just a cut.
A section. Yeah,
a section. And here again about the individuality and the memory, it's a work also about the institution of army. There we were speaking about how you take away the humanity of a person when you take away its personality by putting it in a group and in a situation who doesn't belong to it. In the institution of the army, you take away from a person the possibility to make a choice. And I think that's the most linked thing to a person. You can always decide, I do this or I don't do that.
Mm-hmm.
As a soldier, you cannot do that anymore.
Yeah.
So there's something that's, again, taken very deep into what you are, taken away from you, and with that, your personality. And the way the symmetries, they are done with the process, very cold and repetitive, there is little place for personality, too. And I chose to work with these Satzkasten, you say in German, Satzkasten.
Yes.
It's a tradition that you find in Germany when they took, you know, when the prince, yeah, before
letters.
The letters, they were put in these small kasten. How do you say, tiroir?
Drawers.
Thank you, drawers.
Yeah.
And once the technology of printing changed, they didn't know really what to do with them.
Yeah.
And the Germans have this tendency to try to tidy up and put everything in its place. So they kind of created this tradition at homes to create internal memorials somehow, where they would put things that maybe had some sense, for children it's mostly, and collect small things and put them inside of these drawers. And it was a way for them also to tidy up, but also to forget them. So mm-hmm. once they have their place, you don't really need to take care of them.
Yeah.
And I felt there was something, this parallel with the memorial, idea of memorial in general. Okay, we put some money in it and we glorify our debts, but okay, it's there and we don't really have to think about it.
Yeah, yeah.
So there is this kind of a parallel of domestic memorial and on the level of a state. Yeah.
They become like records. I mean, like, you know, once you file
yeah.
them.
Yeah, there's something archival yeah. in it also. Yeah.
And so all of the works we've been kind of looking at so far, they somehow relate to your own response to postcolonial theory and, you know, positioning yourself into the, you know, legacy and history, I guess. Whilst the next piece where we're going to be talking about, which I guess is Impunities, it's kind of bringing us back again to the now and the present and London, which I think is, you know, it would be an interesting move in the conversation, because I think we grasp a little bit of a sense of the direction the work has been taken in that area. And this is kind of bringing violence, the notion of violence, into a different realm.
Mm-hmm. A different, but also... we are still in this, that this work is in the context of the Cabinet of Souls, so the show is divided in two sub-shows, the Cabinet of Souls and the Future Rewound, and it's all about these wounded or injured souls, and also about these forgotten stories, these invisible events that took place, but actually they all determine our present and what we are today, because I think personally things are connected and they don't really disappear. So that's why that's on the underfloor, basement. Voila, which is the support of the future we want.
Right.
So this all of the idea of the colonialism and suppressing others has always a kind of reverberation and effect on our presence. And the, as you said, this work about impunities is from the present. I did it during the residencies at the FINA Foundation. And what I basically did is to work with people who underwent domestic violence. And so I took prints of psychological and physical scars. In this case, we see only the physical scars because it's really literally prints of their wounds on their bodies that I realized with the forensic technique. So as criminologist would work with the black powder and the film, the sweat,
yeah,
it produces a print. And so it's a collection of 20 prints. And
so basically monoprints type of thing.
Yeah. And this was the basis of the final work, because this is like the preparation. So it's the originals, and the final work was engraved in glass. The same prints were engraved in glass so that it becomes, it's really between visibility and invisibility. It was engraved in a sense that you feel it was someone just touched and left, and you're not sure if there is a print or there isn't. A little bit like the issue about the domestic violence is that it's a domesticized from the society, somehow the violence that is accepted, and hence invisible. The invisibility comes from the fact that it's not really this crime, that you don't, it's not easy to set the limits because it happens behind the doors, and there's always this thing, how far can I go in the privacy? And that's the danger. I mean, when you don't have clear limits, the victims don't really always realize that they're victims, and
sure,
they don't really know how to cope with that. So it's things that, this kind of invisible violences that we all are surrounded with and we don't know how to deal or to see it. And most of my works are always about this barrier to see it or you don't see it, but there's something uncomfortable about it, everything,
sure,
you know.
And do we want to maybe move forward to all along the watchtower, mm-hmm. which is also a piece that you will have a chance to see at the mosaic rooms. And I think it's quite... We might skip just one part of the presentation. Oh, actually, this one is very interesting in that it goes back to this idea of transparency and, you know, how creative is kind of ephemeral traces.
And how our sight, how we look at things, actually completely different from the machine,
for sure.
The apparatus.
So this is you.
This is in the street, the Bank District in London. And this piece, now we're going to the other floor, Future Rewound, upstairs. And so what I basically did is to create a kind of window, go back to what Alberti said, painting is an open window to the world, but I really took it literally. And I drew what I saw, so I traced, and I didn't draw what my mind sees. And that's really tricky. Because your mind tries to always
fill in
the blanks, and if you concentrate only on the lines, there are only blanks, and the eye is moving all the time. Quite a nightmare to produce this work. You have to have only one eye always like this, and with every breath, everything moves.
So for most other artists, this would have been a performance. You said.
I'm not a performance artist, but it is somehow everyone stopped and talked to me and whatever. So, what I did, I drew how I could on this transparent film, which then later I used it as a support to reproduce the drawing with transparent varnish on glass. And the whole thing is then visible through light. It's a shadow. So when you shed the spotlight on the glass, you can see the shadow of the work on the wall. And it looks as if the drawing is done with water. Mm. It's a watery drawing. And it's completely vanishing. Your own shadow can cover it at every moment. And so this is a work about, it's a series, ongoing series, and I will be working only in financial districts of different cities of the world. Started with London. Impunities, by the way, is also a series started in London. I don't know why this is happening. Starting in London. So this is the Bank District, and the idea is of the future, it's in the context of the Future Rewound, the upstairs show. It's about the invisible prisons or the confinements in which we live, the invisible walls that surround us. And the financial district, or let's say the financial world that is presented to us as the only alternative, even after the collapse, is a kind of
the crisis.
Not yet.
Well, there had been a moment where it was collapsed. Let's embrace it.
Yeah. If it happens a second time, I don't know how we survive it. Whatever. So the idea is that you have a perspective that doesn't open on a real perspective. It opens on an opaque wall. So there is no perspective somehow. And also this idea of the shadow that comes in and out, it shows also its fragility. And that the realities that seem really solid, I don't know how solid they are. It's always everything can change and be something else. And
it's about the transparency, as you said.
Yeah.
Because since it's done with transparent varnish and you cannot really see the drawing, it's discovered the outlines via the shadow on the wall. It's about this idea, this ideology of transparency, which is totally linked to the banks, the banking sector.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All the buildings are always
everything
transparent.
Is so transparent that you finally can see nothing.
And actually, the more the buildings are transparent, the more what's happening that is really opaque.
But I think it's also interesting because allegedly this area is one of the highest monitor areas in the world. There's the highest concentration of CCTV cameras, and you know, there's literally not a single inch without recording.
They're present. I didn't look for them, but every perspective that I took, there is one camera on it. And I realized afterwards, and I was like, wow, that's not bad, because we have all on the watch or just behind.
I was just about to say, exactly. You just kind of give it to me, because it's taking us into the next body of work. Is right here, and where surveillance and control and monitoring is actually, you know, a key component, I guess, for reading this piece, which you can probably describe to us.
Yes, so this, what we're seeing, is the image of the work all along the watchtower that was produced once in the Herbert Johnson Museum of Art in Ithaca. And we did another version of All Along the Watchtower. It's not a watchtower. It's a reference to the song. and to the Vietnamese War, but Vietnam War, but it's actually a hunting stand, and I was interested to see how the shape of a hunting stand and its function is very analog to a watchtower. So what the hunting stand does is to supervise the forest, protect it, but very often animals are killed. And the watchtower, in all wall separations, or frontiers or anywhere, you also protect the borders, and most of the time people are killed. Sure. So the idea here is the parallel between how humans in a hyper-capitalized society sometimes can be treated as animals, not directly, but by effects and reverberations again. And the idea of the work, if you come to the show, hopefully this is the effect, you don't know really where the shadow exactly comes from.
Yeah, not when you tell it now.
Yeah, I'm not going to say it, but it's this, you don't know if you're being supervised.
Yeah, this is a plot spoiler, you know.
Yeah, right? But I'm supposed to talk about the work. But the idea, without talking about directly the effect of the work, is you don't know in our situation how we live often. Now, when I did the work, we didn't know about how far we are being spied, and how complete it is. So now we know it. But at that time, when I produced this in 2012, there was only a feeling that everywhere, somewhere, probably can get information that probably you don't want to say about yourself. Mm-hmm. And it's soft because we all accept it. And we think it will not affect us directly. I mean, I have nothing to hide at the end of the day. But you also never know it can return itself on you. So there is this thing of comfortable, yes, because everyone is living like this and I cannot just be the only one who's marginal.
Yeah.
And at the same time, it can freak you out because you're not free anymore at the end of the day. So I was hoping that this work with it's a representation of a shadow, but done in a way that you almost think that it's there.
Yeah, and also I think it's this idea that there are power structures and forms of control and which are kind of evanescent, not very material, mm-hmm. very intangible, and
exactly.
I think that's what the work conveys powerfully.
Yeah.
It's this idea that it's more a threat, which
exactly.
is kind of incumbent, but you don't really know how to articulate it.
And the shadow is always something that can go away.
Can go away, you know.
It's like air, you know. There's
yeah.
nothing. That's why the object that produces the shadow is absent.
Mm-hmm. And so, going again into the idea of monitoring and controlling, particularly borders and access and entrance, and of course, like you know, international mobilities and how that relates to individuals when you know they do hold different type of passports, or you know they are from different nationalities. This is kind of opening up into. I'm sorry, I'm kind of skipping into no.
No, I think you're going to know, yeah.
And which is a piece which is very dear to me because we work on it
how
together.
We met together,
and that's how we met. And so we presented that work. We premiered that work and co-produced it for the Liverpool Biennial 2012. And the idea of that show was to try to unpack the notion of political hospitality and how the world is hospitable or not hospitable according to many different factors and what that means in a biennial context, which is meant to be creating an hospitable space for both artists and viewers where to you know, think and reflect about art. And so there's a very specific rhetoric in biennials about you know, hospitalities, and that's what we were trying to look at. You propose this project, and I said yes and not no.
It's not about yes and no.
Exactly.
When you can never say yes,
exactly.
You're actually saying somehow yes because of the no negatively, whatever.
So I love this work because you know it's very political, it's very pertinent to you know a situation that many people do experience, and many other people they're not even aware of. It's this, you know, the simple fact that you can be negated access to, mm-hmm. you know, realities or dimensions. But you kind of twisted it a little bit, and you twisted it again by introducing the idea of a performed identity for mm-hmm. the benefit of the interlocutor, which is kind of going back to the piece with the tribes at the beginning, because mm-hmm. this idea, like, you know, okay,
the group again, yeah,
are going to be performing collectively in order to benefit your interests or, you know, your understanding. So, what is Noah about?
it's a UK border agency,
two channel big installation. So, it's an immersive space,
yeah,
where you enter into a sort of an antagonism, I guess, a dialogue which is actually between two adversaries.
As a spectator, you're taking in an ongoing dialogue which is happening between a mouth and a core of people,
a choir
of people in the church. And yeah, you asked what is it? It's basically about the UK Border Agency, and it's actually an extreme.
Actually, the UK Border Agency wrote the script.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a contributor to the story.
It's wordly wrote the script. We didn't take one word outside of what the UK Border Agency wrote. It's related to a personal experience, but as you said, many people don't even realize that this happens, that this is possible, and others go through it. So when I wanted to come, it's every time a pain, by the way, for me to come to the UK. Other countries less. As a Tunisian, it's not easy to travel. A Russian today, even worse. So I don't even try with my Russian passport. So the first time I wanted to come here was for a talk, and I was not able to get. I got my visa much later, but I had to go through the whole process. And when I had to answer the questions, we were doing it together, by the way, and I was really all the time between laughing and almost crying. Mm-hmm. Laughing because it's surrealistic, the question. I'm not believing what I'm reading. And did you commit the genocide? Are you implicated in, I don't know what, the terrorism?
International terrorism.
Stuff. And you cannot say yes, no question. And even if you are, what's the point? You're not going to
say yes. Right.
So it's just as if it's a humiliating process. That's it. You want to come to the UK, so come. We're going to humiliate you. Yeah. There's something.
The interesting thing is that the UK border agency don't want to know who you are. They just want to make sure that you are not.
You're not those categories.
Certain model of terrorism.
But they also don't make sure, because I mean, this kind of.
Yeah, okay. They want if you answer to one question yes, I'm sure that you will not be granted a visa without any resistance.
Yeah.
But if you say no to all questions, it's better. So smooth.
So, and then we started to sing this, somehow it came with the singing.
Because it was ridiculous. It was annoying and ridiculous, and we did it for an hour, and then just out of the mood, we started to chant it.
I don't know why, but that was really a key moment, because this is how we got into the idea of the church.
Well, I mean, you do, because it's a liturgy.
The idea of the liturgy, and we got into this inquisitioning atmosphere and the roots of the question, which is called inquiry, inquisition, church. And then as an African coming to Europe, to the European continent, the Africans that immigrate, they immigrate with the hope, seeing the European continent, the Christian continent, as the continent of the hope. But on the other side, it's both things. Some of them are being accepted and they really have a better life. Others die in between or struggle within. It's a complicated, so it's not a work about saying who's bad or good. It's just this complex and ridiculous situation somehow, you know, things you don't know how to deal with, so you find a law or a thing that doesn't help you, but I did something. It's almost like Tunisian Americans, okay, there's a memorial, it's there, we did something. So what we did also, the idea of the humor, because the situation is very uncomfortable, and it was much stronger to bring through the unease through the humor.
Yeah.
So what basically, if you come, I don't want to describe it, but shortly, the people in the church, they're answering the inquiry that the mouth is singing in a liturgical manner. And
one word to the church, it's an Anglican church in the center of the Medina in Tunis. Mm-hmm. The St. George Church. And we wanted to do this in a church, not only because of the connection to inquisition processes, but also because of the idea that it's a nave. It's referring to Noah's Ark.
Sure.
And many Africans come to come illegally via naves, via boats, which is a huge tragedy of the Mediterranean. Mm. And we wanted to use this symbolism also to get this.
Okay. Thank you. I think it's time to open it up to the audience. Have you got any questions or is any curiosity or comment you want to make? Otherwise, we're going to keep going. We've got plenty of work to talk about. No? So maybe we can talk, you know, because we were coming from a sort of biennial context with the production of Beasties, we can probably move into Flying Carpets, which is the next one, and is also bringing to another very important, prestigious venues for biennials, which is Venice. Mm-hmm. And so Flying Carpets, I believe, was firstly presented for during the Venice Biennale, right?
No, the first time in Dubai.
Oh, okay.
It was I was granted the Abraj Capital Art Prize.
Yeah.
And this was the project that I realized for the project.
Okay.
And then it was for the show,
Future of a Promise.
Future of a Promise, yeah. We have a lot of future in that computer.
And so what do we see in this image?
We see profiles, metal profiles hanging on threads.
Yeah, that's the mundane version of the description of it.
And now I will try to describe what is it about, what it is. It's a bridge, basically.
Yeah.
It's the representation of a bridge that is in Venice, and it's called the Ponte del Sepolcro, and this bridge is between Giardini, where you have the Biennale, and San Marco, the most touristic spot of Venice.
Well, probably the planet.
Yeah, probably. I wanted to say, so imagine, the most touristic of Venice, it's... So that's why the shape of the bridge is long on one side and shorter on the other one. So this is basically a documentary sculpture, like most of my work. I don't really invent stuff, I just reproduce or cut and put together, change context. Mm. And this is in the same continuation. So the long part is the part which is close to Giardini, where you have less police. So the street peddlers, they were more confident to put their carpets on the side of the Giardini, and on the side of the San Marco, it's shorter. You have more tourists, but they don't really dare to do it. So what I basically did is, during 1 week, to follow or live, let's say, somehow with the street peddlers who put on, not carpets, but blankets, their goods. And they put their carpets on the blankets I was thinking to protect in the beginning.
No.
But actually it's to fly the coop. So that's why also the work is called Flying Carpets, because their blankets are not a way for them to be free, but it's a kind of their prison. And this is why...
I don't know whether you're familiar with this scene in Venice. I mean, I guess it also in other localities, but occasionally, I think it's very common in Italy, something that you kind of grow with as part of a daily landscape, because all of these are generally illegal in the country. Of course, they're selling illegally, but also they do sell illegal products. Mm-hmm. So, it's the worst situation it can possibly be. Mm-hmm. And yet, that's the only way or means of survival. So the way they do perform their daily business is just to get this huge, big kind of blanket. And as soon as they do perceive there is danger, they collect quickly everything and they run away. Mm-hmm. And so it's really this kind of almost daily performance, mm-hmm, of confidence, I guess, and arrogance sometimes, because they really, defy the authorities as much as they can. Mm. But then when there's no other measure, they have to take off, and then they quickly go. And so it's actually quite amazing to see. And there's this kind of... there's a sort of a power game there, because they wouldn't really fly immediately.
They wait
until the very, very, very last minute.
And also, they see each other, actually. Since I live there, they know when to go, and the police tolerate, but at a certain point they don't tolerate. I don't know what's... there is an internal language, but... And they, between each other, of course, they have their zones. Here they sell these goods, they don't mix in that. It's all very... it's an under-society that is very organized.
Absolutely.
And they all live in Mestre, and so they come at a certain point of the day, and then they go and... breath. The idea of the flying carpet, I wanted to relate to this Orientalist idea of the carpet that can go through everywhere without borders, and the freedom, the romantic idea. And these people who mostly come from the Orient or South, from Africa, and was thinking that in Venice, what I was telling you yesterday, most of the wealth and the beauty of the architecture you see everywhere, the influence of the Orient, is the most, from my view, the most oriental city in Europe, in the sense that there was a lot of exchange with the Islamic and Arab world at that time, and probably the ancestor of these same peddlers at that time were participating also to the growth of the city, and these same people today are being the persona non grata. And I was interested in the switch through the title of flying carpet. They did reuse carpets to fly the coop, but today it's their own prison. That's why the profiles are made in metal, but they're also hovering, so it all feels as if it's going to fly now, but it's trapped into each other.
Mm.
And I was saying documentary because I just took the measures of the carpets, the outlines, every day how they were superposing of each other, and then reproduced it through 3D and with the machines, and every one is hanging on different height, the threads, and they don't touch each other. So if you do this or if there's a wind, they will swing.
Yeah, okay, but they're hanging in a distance of 2 centimeters.
No, 2 centimeters.
2 centimeters.
2 centimeters, yeah.
But again, with this piece, you're kind of solidifying, again, a very evanescent presence, which is there, but at the same time isn't. So this kind of giving, again, visibility to something which is somewhat invisible.
Invisible. And they are invisible. This is the strange thing.
Yeah.
Because they're very present, but no one really, really notices them because they're almost part of the decor. They are there.
But also, I think the other interesting thing is so it's this kind of idea of commuting, because like, you know, their daily presence is in Venice, but at the same time, they're not nightly presence in Venice. They're not residential.
They don't live there.
And so this kind of idea that, you know, they're twice or...
Migrants.
Yeah, twice migrants,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
from into the country, but also within the locality of
that
country, which is, you know, atrocious situation to be in terms of, like, you know, claiming rights or...
And also this idea of the bridge, it is this, all the passage, it's the migration spot somehow from one point to the other.
And also, like, you know, this is, I think it's a quite nice way to, oh, yes.
Okay to
absolutely, interact, yes.
Please do.
It's just, you mentioned about, I really like this idea of documentary sculpture, I think it's great, and it's an area I'm particularly interested in. Do you feel that therefore the context, so you go to a site, and in a way, you're working as a documentarian. Is the context important then when you recreate it within the gallery space? Or do you take that site almost as kind of inspiration and then make it more of a universal kind of piece of work?
My wish is that, as you say, I start very particular. There is nothing more particular than touch. Like, it's really getting into the contact. But my wish is that from that contact, it gets into the universal, for sure. I guess as most of the artists would like that. But it depends also on the works. For example, this work, I was happy that it came back to Venice. I was wishing to find the street peddlers, but they left. So they really, they don't stay a long time, and I didn't find them again. But this was as if going back to the source. And there are several, there's another work that I produced once in Sharjah, and now it's going back. And I'm very happy that these, even if they're not directly site-specific, but they belong to that space. And not all of them, but some of them, it's good that they go back to where they came from. But it all depends on the works. For example, Modulo is another work that we're showing. We produced a new series, extra, for the context of London and Mosaic Room. And when we showed it before somewhere else, it was, so it adapts somehow, and it takes the shape of the place, but there are pieces which can be put anywhere. So, for example, Impunities, it doesn't need to be London, or it doesn't need to be any, this is like a documentation of pain, and it just shouldn't be in a commercial context, for example. This kind of work has to be protected from that. So every work is, you know, has its own... but mostly, hopefully, they can be universal.
Yes. Well, since you mentioned it, should we go back into Modler?
Yeah.
Because I am...
It's also very close to, related to the metal again.
Yep. And so here we do have Utopia, I think, in made space. Again, it's this kind of idea of three-dimensionalizing concepts and conditions, and, you know, giving kind of some presence to what is not visible. So what we have here is an ideal prototype, well, almost archetypical spaces which could contain a human being.
Yeah, unfortunately they do.
And they do. And so you do have this kind of very fine gold lines, brass lines.
Brass lines.
which are marking and defining the height, the width, and the depth of spaces, which are living units in very specific conditions, created around the human body.
Yeah.
Starting from Le Corbusier, who's the initial sinner, right?
Somehow. The work is called Modular, in reference to Le Corbusier. And this is a piece, somehow, again, about these invisible walls that surround us, but going back to very concrete situations, and the brass lines, they show exactly the outlines of the measures of individual unit cells in prisons in different countries of the world.
Special housing units.
So it's mostly for punishment or torture. Some of them are really like the Israeli prison, which has the same dimension of the Tunisian. Yeah. Unfortunately, it looks very much like torture. But we don't have the Tunisian here. So in this case, for this show, we selected only European cells and Israel. So somehow this piece speaks at the same time about the European history and the Palestinian and Israeli history.
Yeah, the causes, it's a causal-effect stories. But it's interesting to create a narration out of the selection of the prison cells. So we have, which is by chance, it was not intended, we have a prison cell from Landsberg am Lech, which is now the prison where Uli Hoeneß, the manager of Bayern Munich, is sitting.
I don't know if you're aware of the scandal, he went to prison because of tax withdrawal.
Yeah, tax withdrawal. So, but it's also the prison where Hitler wrote Mein Kampf. And we have a cell from Buchenwald.
The extermination camp.
Yeah.
So it's cells from actual prisons and from places that became museums or...
Yes. And
and we have English cells. Monaco.
Yeah, prisons. Yeah.
Quite luxurious.
Bigger than most hotels.
Tell me about it. I love it.
I would love to be in one of the cells. They're treated like...
No, they have Tai Chi courses, Tai Chi and yoga, meditation courses every day.
But unfortunately, you must be Monegasque to get in.
Yeah.
Not anyone can get in.
But it's rather like a hotel, like a, let's say, 4-star, 3-star hotel, but with a 5-star program.
It's crazy. How is this laid out? It's not very clear.
How they do the
ground?
Yes, they are support. They are on the floor, and it's all cut, and they touch each other. Yeah,
yeah,
like a grid, exactly.
Like
and you have on the name and the country of the cells on the side, and then when you're in, you can imagine the and they function like a Russian puppet. You say that one into the other.
Actually, it's not always simple to follow the lines, but you need to follow the lines to find yourself in the cell where you are standing.
It's kind of interesting because, like, now I was reflecting about this work yesterday when we were in the space, because, you know, in theory, these spaces have been designed around one human being. But as a matter of fact, for instance, this is very strong. Well, big scandal that we have in Italy, that the population is, you know, the jail population is so big. And the spaces are so limited that they are incredibly overcrowded, and you know,
even
the European community,
for one person, they
you know, has been continuously kind of pushing the government to try to find a solution to that. So, like, you know, even in the notion of confinement, you know, how you can confine one single person in a sort of a fair way, the moment that you actually see the realities, these spaces designed around one person need actually populate sometimes about 10 people.
Oh my God.
And so it's like, you know, if you really reflect to the aftermath of what it was meant to be, like, in a way to systematize again, you know, a certain problem by, you know, giving it the right space, that right space is never really quite right.
Mm. But that's the idea of the modernism. Now we want to go back to modular. It was, from the beginning, the Corbusier was to create an ideal space that would function to the anthropology of the...
A rational space.
Yeah.
Mm. Not the ideal, it's economical.
Yeah, yeah, I did the sense that, yeah, rational, so thought about, and then we see
cost-effective as well, then.
Yeah.
we are caught into this also modern rationalism, and again, this is one of the invisible prisons that the work is, that we, the whole show is talking about. But through the concrete prisons, we are actually talking about the wider one where we're all caught in. It doesn't have to be walls, it's just the structure, everyday life. 9-to-5 job is one of these, for example.
Yeah, and when you miss the structure, one day your prison will have walls.
Could have walls, yeah.
Can come to the point. But there was one thing you said which is quite interesting, because the whole criticism against prisons is about solitary confinement and not at all about the space. It's so difficult to find the measures of prison cells. Even the NGOs that work about this, they don't consider space as a problem. They just consider solitary confinement and punishment as a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is now, when they consider solitary confinement as a problem, and you skip the space problem, the question is, when, at what size of the cell, the double, when you share the cell, at what size of the cell it becomes a problem? So when we consider that two inmates is more more humanitarian confinement than solitary confinement, the question is it on each scale, or does it depend on a certain size of the cell that two inmates is even worse than being one?
Thank you, I would say. And thank you so very much for joining us today.
Thank you.